This is the Old Republic podcast.
Spoiler warning for the Knights of the Old Republic series, Star Wars, the Old Republic, and all other media.
This is where the fun begins.
Let's remind the Jedi what happens when the weak seek to match metal with the Dark Lords of the Sith.
Sir, from the surviving officer's reports, Lord Revan has gone down with the ship.
He's still alive.
Well, hello, Brian. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. It is a nice kind of early summer day. So I've been outside running some errands, but I'm really excited for what we're going to be talking about today. It's a little book that you pointed out to me and said it was going to tie in really nicely to what we've been talking about here in the prequel trilogy. So I'm having a great day. How are you doing?
Doing great. Not dying of allergies. I did forget my headphones today, so I kind of britted this episode, but hopefully the sound will be okay-ish, you know. So
that's right. Yeah, I think it'll be okay. I think the sound will be all right. So you didn't Brita it too bad. Not like everyone's favorite Brita from Community, if you don't know that one there. Definitely watch Community. Also good. But definitely what else you should do that is also good is pick up the Star Wars Heresies, because it is a good read.
Yeah, so this is by Paul F. McDonald. It's titled The Star Wars Heresies, Interpreting the Themes, Symbols, and Philosophies of Episodes 1, 2, and 3. It is such a fun book because I love Star Wars and, you know, kind of like some nice literate critiques and articles and stuff. And there's a lot out there for the original trilogy, but not so much for the prequel trilogy or sequel trilogy at this time, but this is like the first book I've kind of perused with like scholarship on the prequels, and it might just blow anything else out of the water, I think.
Yeah, it's a really good analytical look at the prequel trilogy, like you said, Cassia, because there's not a lot of stuff that really dives into, you know, kind of the inner workings of the story. You know, there's a bunch of stuff that talks about, you know, the original trilogy and, you know, behind the scenes books and like the Tashin archive books and stuff like the Magic and Myth tour that talked, you know, kind of about this mythology behind it and, you know, the stories that kind of inspired, you know, the stories and the story structure of the original trilogy. But there's not a lot out there about the prequel trilogy, and even less about the sequel trilogy. So if you're listening out there and you have some good tips for us on what to read, let us know that. But yeah, I thought that this book was really great, and I really liked kind of the way that it is structured. Like, it's easy to read through. Like, when you think of something that's gonna, you know, analyze a story and talk about it like mythologically, you're like, I don't know, that could get a little bit too much in the weeds for me. But this book is really perfect. It's very compact. It's very digestible, easy to read, and it's broken down really well, so it makes sense. So if you're familiar with the story of The Phantom Menace, or, you know, Attack of the Clones, Revenge of the Sith, then this is a really good book to, you know, kind of do a little bit more digging on why those stories got told and why they were told the way that they were told.
Yeah, some interesting details on this book is I believe it came out like right before the Lucasfilms sailed to Disney. So it's kind of like a little nugget in time. It's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. This came out, let's see, my copy here at least has the copyright of 2013. And the most striking thing about the book, when you very first pick it up, it has this amazing illustration on the front, which looks kind of like a religious painting. And it is called The Chosen One. It's by Chawakarn Kongspersert. I don't know if I'm saying that incorrectly. Please correct me or let me know how to say it. But this piece of artwork is really striking. I don't know if it's part of that Visions art book we've talked about here on the podcast before. I'd have to go back and double check. But I love this illustration, and it definitely gets you in the right kind of mindset and sets the tone for what you're about to start reading.
Yeah, I believe this book was mentioned in the prequel Strike Back, which I've watched a couple times. I believe you've watched a couple times, and we've kind of mentioned it on and off on the podcast, but I believe I got this book like the summer of 2020, and I finished it in early 2021. So it took me a few months to get through. It was really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I had seen this book on the internet and things a couple of times, and you know, seen people posting pictures of it on Instagram and Twitter and stuff like that. But I'd never actually read it myself. But then you and I decided we were going to start going through kind of the Skywalker saga of films, talking about them on, you know, the hero's journey side. So you probably heard that episode last week for the Phantom Menace. But we wanted to kind of, you know, look at it from, you know, the story structure itself of the hero's journey, but then talk about it as well from a more mythological stance. So that's where this book is going to come in here today when we're talking about the prequel trilogy and, you know, the Phantom Menace in particular today.
Yeah. And what I like is the introduction kind of says that Star Wars, the saga, is very literate. Like, some people just say like, oh, Star Wars has no scholarly merit, you know? It's just kind of like, it's simple, fun stuff. Like, maybe the original trilogy has some nice Eastern thoughts and, like, a hero's journey, but, like, prequel trilogy, like, hell no. There's nothing there. Right. It's just made for toys. And it's like, this book, like, really kind of shows, like, wrong! They're very literate films, and I guess there's difference between criticizing and critiquing something. Mm-hmm. And like looking at things analytically, like the prequel's execution was hit and miss, like not great, but I think their intent and style is worth noting, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And Paul F. McDonald does a really good job through kind of the chapters of this book in particular of, you know, talking about, you know, the stories of, you know, the Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, and in a way where it's, you know, presenting the story and what kind of inspired those story sections while still acknowledging, you know, that the parts that people didn't, you know, care for or agree with or caused, you know, controversy on, you know, it doesn't really kind of brush that under the rug, you know, it acknowledges that, but then it, you know, takes that step forward to try to kind of understand it and explain it, which is really nice because, you know, all too often, especially here in this internet age that we're in, you know, if you don't like something, it's very easy to say, I don't like this. But, you know, it's harder to say, I don't like this, but you know, if I think about it, you know, in this way, I can understand this, or I can understand the intent of this. And this book does a really good job of, you know, kind of writing that line between critique and criticism. And I really liked that. It was very refreshing.
Yeah. And this episode, you'll probably hear a lot of like me, like rustling pages, but that's what happens when you're looking at a very intricate book, like we're kind of looking at. So it's kind of fun, though. This book is divided into three sections. And did you note how many pages the Phantom Menace section have?
Yeah, so the Phantom Menace section, it starts on page 11 and it runs through page 66, so order 66. So just, yeah, 55, 56 pages here for the Phantom Menace. And it's about that same size for the other three, although I think that, you know, kind of the bulk of the storytelling here is in the Phantom Menace, because that's really what's setting up the story, what's setting up these characters, and, you know, drawing on those inspirations, you know, from mythology and religion and things like that.
Yeah. So are you ready to dive into the Living Force?
Absolutely. Let's dive into the Living Force.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting because, like, kind of what makes Star Wars different from a lot of, like, other stories, like fantasy or, like, medieval, you know, is the Force. It's kind of like, is it alive? Is it sentient? You know, like, it's mysterious. It's mystical. It's like, interesting. It's, like, it's mythic, you know, and Obi-Wan described it in A New Hope as the Force is what gives the Jedi his power. It's an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us. It penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. And one thing I noted when I was reading this, it said in the annotated screenplays of the original trilogy, Lucas outlined his ideas in early story conferences. The act of living generates a force field and energy. That energy surrounds us. There is a giant mass of energy in the universe that has a good side and a bad side. We are part of the force because we generate the power that makes the force live. When we die, we become part of that force, so we never really die. What did you think of this section?
Yeah, I really liked kind of this section. It's kind of like a preamble, I guess, to getting into the Phantom Menace to set up how the Force works kind of in the prequel trilogy. But I really like this in the way, you know, that McDonald is describing the Force and bringing it in, you know, really tying it back to more of those religious type of roots, you know, that the Force is this kind of living, almost animate thing, you know, that can reside, you know, within us and around us. And we talk about that a little bit more as we get into the chapters here for the Phantom Menace. But I really liked kind of this early description of it, because it really sets the tone for something like the Phantom Menace, which, you know, heavily relies on something that is a wee bit controversial in the fandom, and that is midichlorians. But I think that this section right here does a really good job of kind of laying out why those are going to make sense when we talk about it here in just a minute.
Yeah, like, I never really understood, like, the furor over midichlorians. Because I guess I was, like, kid when the prequel trilogy came out. And, like, in my mind, like, I mean, like, when you kind of, like, grow up within religious traditions, like, you kind of have, like, your religious brain and science brain. I had that too, and mm-hmm. I always kind of just assume like it's two ways of looking at the same truth, you know, and that's how I saw it. Like, it's a story, it's just they're all looking at the elephant a different way.
Yeah, exactly. And you think of something like the Force, like the Jedi, there had to have been, you know, some sort of marker that allowed the Jedi Order to identify you know, individuals that were, you know, more force sensitive than others, right? So it only makes sense there would be some sort of marker within people, you know, that would be, you know, kind of indicative of how in tune with the Force they may or may not become, you know, at some point. So
yeah, and like, maybe it's a simple test, maybe it's flawed, but maybe it caught most of the force sensitives in the galaxy. But, like, maybe, like, say, like, an IQ test, like, maybe it's not given to everyone, or, like, it can be corrupted, or, like, it doesn't catch, like, divergences in thinking, you know? So that's mm-hmm. that's how I see it. But what I noticed is on page 8, it says, like, while the Jedi Council often seem fixated on the distant past or uncertain future, the living force is, by contrast, grounded in the present moment, the here and now, the only reality we can truly know. As such, it is also steeped in flashes of intuition and focused spontaneity, as well as an empathy with and deep connection to all beings.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just that, and that way that you're, you know, describing the force, that McDonald is describing the force here in this section is really going to lean into, you know, kind of our characters that are using the force here in the Phantom Menace. That's why I think that this kind of little intro bit to the force is so important, because, you know, on one hand, he's describing it, you know, as this kind of Zen, be in the moment section that we're going to talk about here in Qui-Gon section. But, you know, there's more, you know, reactive bits to it, you know, when you talk about stuff like the Jedi Council and the way that Obi-Wan is responding to the force and the way he is interacting with Qui-Gon. So I think that, yeah, I think that it just does a really nice job through this section of, you know, describing the Force as this living kind of animate thing that you, you know, is going to, you know, kind of react and cause response differently, you know, from person to person, you know, just like anything else, right? You're bringing your own kind of background and experiences into it. So the way that you interpret the Force is going to be different from person to person as well.
Yeah, and a lot of philosophies and belief systems all over the world throughout, like, the millennia that they've been around, like, most of them, like, talk about, like, concentrating on the present moment and Kind of like sometimes I'm like, what's the allegory? Like, what does the force represent in our world? And I think like maybe I could be wrong and there's many interpretations, but I kind of see it as like mental clarity, like following your bliss, like not in a hedonistic sense, but kind of a Campbellian sense, like you're kind of doing, you're contributing what only you can contribute, and you're not living in the past, you're not living in the future, you're just being. Like, what do you see it as?
Yeah, exactly. It's very akin to, yeah, kind of that Campbellian, sort of follow your bliss, follow your own journey kind of a thing, is kind of the way that I see it. And one of the interesting things about this book, I think, is that it doesn't necessarily, declare it to be something. And, through the sections of the book, it doesn't necessarily declare that, this is exactly what this is. It throws out a couple of examples of things that it could have been and allows you to kind of, think about it from some different perspectives. I think that's what the force is ultimately. It's just kind of your own personal perspective and interpretation of how you want to, live and conduct and reside in the world, right? Like how empathetic do you want to be, and how in touch with nature do you want to be, and how, compassionate do you want to be? Like those are all, those are things that are all around us, all capabilities that we all have, and it's just, down to each individual, kind of person to then decide, how much percentage of themselves they want to put into those different buckets. And that's kind of how I see the force in my own head anyways.
Yeah. And then there is this one kind of section that kind of blew my mind. It's on page 9. It says, Buick's commentary brings to mind the passage in Terry Brooks' novelization of The Phantom Menace regarding how the Jedi began as a theological or philosophical study group, and it took an enormous amount of time before they even became aware of the Force. One has to wonder if Buick's experience of cosmic consciousness was all that different from the first Jedi who spontaneously realized he or she was immersed in a vast field of living energy. It continues, equally intriguing is the realization that beings in the galaxy far, far away create the Force rather than the other way around. So, in a way, it's kind of not like the Force created the universe from ex nihilo, it's kind of like the living beings create it. As Yoda himself said, life creates it, makes it grow. Once again, establishing that the living force that is being discussed as taught by Qui-Gon.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of ties into to a lot of mythology and ancient stories and ancient civilizations, and the way that they would have described things or understood things, is directly related to the time and the place in which they lived, right? There's like this Viking folklore that says that every night a wolf comes up and eats the, I remember it was the sun or the moon, which makes as much sense as anything else, because you don't understand that the earth is rotating yet, right? So I really like kind of that layout. Like, would the ancient Jedi, or carriers of the Force, or worshippers of this thing, would they have realized that that's even what it was, or it would have just been a part of this world that they didn't fully understand, and tried to explain how it worked, in the best kind of terms that they had available at the time. So I really like kind of, that thought process there.
Yeah. So too long didn't listen or too long didn't read. Midichlorians are awesome. George Lucas did nothing wrong and
That's
midichlorians are perfect. So
right.
yeah.
Midichlorians rule, and if you don't like midichlorians, you probably don't have enough midichlorians yourself.
Yeah. I don't know. Like when I die, I'm like, I wish I spent more time arguing about Star Wars, in life and all that. So
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
just kidding. But yeah, what did you think of the symbiosis section?
Yeah, so we get into the Phantom Menace here, part one. So it's broken down into a couple. I don't remember exactly how many parts there are. Not that many, really. But the first one here is the symbiosis. So each section kind of talks about something, you know, in particular pertaining to the story or the characters here of the Phantom Menace. So the symbiosis is really talking about kind of that yin and yang, you know, black and white, kind of two sides of all of these things. And there are a couple things, you know, that stand out to me here in this section, you know, and that kind of first one being, you know, both really relating to Queen Amidala, Padme, and, you know, the people of Naboo. So you have the people in Naboo and the Gungans, who are these, you know, two people who live, you know, symbiotically on one hand, but, you know, largely ignore each other and are distrustful of the other. And then you have, you know, Padme Amidala herself, you know, kind of playing these two roles. And then obviously you have, you know, Sidious and Palpatine and, you know, the Jedi and the Sith. So, you know, a lot of this, you know, dark side, light side, you know, two sides of the coin, sort of stuff going on here in the Phantom Menace. So I thought the symbiosis section was pretty interesting. What about you? What stood out to you about the symbiosis bit here?
It talked about how the Star Wars galaxy kind of touches on like balance, unity, wholeness. And I mean, it's kind of like one big circle all the way down to like the microscopic, you know, like midichlorians, it's in balance. And that touches on like many symbolic traditions without the world, like in Eastern and Western thought, even the medicine wheel of Native Americans, the Holy Round Table of Arthurian legends. And I just thought it was cool because like the Star Wars galaxy like has a balance of light and dark sides. And then I also like how it pointed out like maybe I wish this would have been more pointed out in the movie itself, but kind of like the symbiosis, you know, between the Nubians, I think it's Nubians or Nubuians. I'm going to say Nubians. It sounds better to me. And the Gungans, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Cause that is a, you know, kind of an important theme, in the movie, but it's not really one that gets addressed that much. You get a little bit of, I think Jar Jar is saying, you know, that the people of Naboo, you know, don't trust, you know, the Gungans and, you know, kind of vice versa. But I think it would have been, you know, really interesting to kind of play into that a little bit more, which is why at the end of the film, kind of that unification of the, you know, the two, you know, peoples of the planet of Naboo coming together is so important. So, yeah, so I really liked that kind of aspect of it. And that's not really something that I had, you know, put much thought into about the Phantom Menace prior to having read this book. So I really like that, you know, that got kind of pointed out to me and I can do a little bit more thinking on that.
Yeah, so there's always stuff you can analyze and maybe to an extent you can look deeply into anything, but I think that this book kind of just illuminates like more of the story choices in The Phantom Menace, and like it helps me appreciate it more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the author backs up everything they say very well. So, I mean, some people can just say, like, you can like find depth in a puddle. And I'm like, well, maybe it's just an awesome puddle, you know? Or like maybe it's not really a puddle, but something that you can analyze.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The you know, the book, kind of the structure, it does a really good job of, you know, pointing out the sources and interviews and other materials that it used to kind of come to the conclusions that you're getting through the chapters here. So definitely well appreciated, because yeah, like you said, you can kind of look at anything and analyze it, but this one, you know, goes the extra mile to make this more of like an actual like research type of a book, as opposed to, yeah, you know, just kind of a random thoughts thrown together. So I like that, and the effort that went into it as well.
Yeah. Then the next section, maybe you could label them all number 10, you know, but just kidding. This is the second one. It's the Master. It's about Qui-Gon Jinn and kind of like the little epigram at the beginning says, always remember your focus determines your reality. And that's from Qui-Gon Jinn.
Yeah, absolutely. And the second chapter here, the Master, about Qui-Gon Jinn, it leans heavily on kind of that first section that we talked about a little bit more at length there about the living force and how that relates specifically to Qui-Gon, because it's, you know, basically kind of going through and laying out Qui-Gon's journey in the Phantom Menace as kind of this Zen Buddhist, you know, inspired sort of story, I guess. You know, always, you know, being present, always remaining calm, has kind of this childlike playfulness to him. He points out, you know, kind of in the with the gambling with Watto and the, you know, poking fun at Padme and stuff like that. So I really like this section to breathe a little bit of life into Qui-Gon Jinn here.
Yeah, and I just like this section of a sentence. It says he wordlessly illustrates everything a Jedi should be.
Yeah, absolutely. And we kind of get into that here in a little bit of a later section of the book. But yeah, it talks about how Qui-Gon is kind of, you know, this living embodiment of everything that the Jedi are supposed to be or are supposed to, you know, try to achieve, you know, within themselves, kind of this perfect embodiment of what that is, which is, you know, why it's so devastating to the galaxy then when he meets his end at the end of the film.
Yeah, just kind of reading that whole section, it's like, oh, I think that's kind of like what the Jedi are meant to be, because even though like the Jedi Council in the prequels like is filled up of good people, like together, like they're kind of just focused on codes, customs, and politics. Like their focus is on the wrong thing. And I think like Qui-Gon just kind of sees through it and just kind of is what a Jedi is supposed to be. And it just is like reading the section, you're like, oh, Anakin could have had the best teacher, but duel of fates, man, happened. So.
That's right. Yeah, it happened and it messed everyone up, Anakin included for sure. But yeah, I really like the section of the Master here, you know, and kind of the ways, all of the ways that, you know, Qui-Gon is living this zenful kind of peaceful existence within the Force. I thought that was really great, especially as, you know, we're kind of on the threshold of this impending, you know, war and turmoil within the galaxy, to be this kind of calm presence. I think it even goes on to talk about how, you know, kind of calm and collected he is, you know, when they're underwater there and with Jar Jar in that little submarine, and, you know, talking about how there's always a bigger fish, right? He's never one to get flustered, and really kind of imparted that stuff into Obi-Wan. Which is pretty neat. It's neat to go back and kind of think about that more analytically. So,
yeah, if I ever get a tattoo, it would probably be a Zen circle. So, just love like Zen thoughts, you know, and stoicism, I guess. So,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So then the next chapter section is titled "The Queen," and I love this intro. Long before Princess Leia ever wove her hair into buns and challenged an empire, her mother sat on a throne of Naboo. The galaxy was in a more civilized age then, not yet ravaged by civil war nor brutalized by a tyrannical government like Amidala herself. The planet she ruled appeared young and beautiful, as though always fresh with morning dew. And kind of like when we were doing our Attack of the Clones from a Hero's Journey perspective, we kind of talked about how like Naboo is kind of like, feels kind of like Eden, you know, and like, and Padme kind of seemed like the Eve to Anakin's Adam. And like, what I like is that Naboo just feels like a life, a world that's like full of life and nature, and it's usually ruled over by young queens. They have matriarchal societies, and you just kind of see like politics and art, you know. It's kind of like a idealized like India mixed with Italy, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like in this section, you know, it kind of talks about, you know, kind of the stories in the background for Padme, Queen Amidala, is kind of this character who's portraying you know, kind of this idyllic great goddess type of a figure here, you know, head of a, you know, kind of a more matriarchal society, is one that can, you know, bring life and unite people that are together. And I really liked, you know, that kind of thinking, the way that, you know, her character was created and, you know, her importance to the role of the Phantom Menace. And, you know, obviously, and, you know, being kind of this motherly, I guess, figure to, you know, the young Anakin that we meet, but, you know, also as this character who's able to, you know, kind of, you know, shift in and out of, you know, being, you know, a more common, you know, handmaiden, and, you know, the queen of these people, able to unite, you know, the people of Naboo and the Gungans together. And then that's all kind of encapsulated. Then I really liked kind of the written imagery, then speaking about Amidala at the end of the film, wearing this white, almost wedding gown, and sort of like this, you know, ceremonial, like literal uniting of the people of her planet. I really liked, you know, that kind of stuff here through her section.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of like in the prequels, you kind of see like, it kind of like centers around like Naboo, you know, but then like kind of when the dark side rises, it's kind of more like we see like the Empire, it's Emperor Palpatine and Darth Vader, and like kind of like a patriarchal empire, like and their emphasis is more like on machines and precise, clean, like almost like antiseptics, you know, like kind of like medical rooms, like not that that's bad, but it's just like very sterile, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think yeah, like I said, this does a really good job of you know, kind of illustrating her as that, you know, that great goddess type of a figure here for the story. And you know, there's definitely a lot of inspiration to be drawn from those, you know, tales, and certainly went into you know, the creation of Amidala Padme, you know, the character here in the story. So I found that stuff pretty fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, like we've kind of mentioned this, like I kind of wish like Padme would have had more to do in episodes 2 and 3, but there still is more going on like than people I think realize. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, are we ready for Anakin's chapter?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so this is titled The Slave. And we kind of mentioned this, like, in our Attack of the Clones. From a hero's journey perspective, we kind of did a little mini game, you know, like on all the steps of courtly love and stuff. But it talks about how the meeting of Anakin Skywalker and Padme Amidala in Mos Espa is kind of like a collision of opposites. It's boy, girl, slave queen, peasant, royalty, hero, and goddess. Like, mm-hmm. Their relationship that would form would shape the galaxy. So it's like kind of like Mother Earth meeting, like, literally someone whose name is, like, Skywalker, you know, like Sky Daddy, Sky Father. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I like in this section, you know, it's talking about, obviously the section here is about Anakin, you know, titled The Slave, but it talks about how to Anakin that Padme is this character, is described in the book as an anima, which is basically a character who's, or a figure that is kind of changing within the psyche of the character here. So in Anakin's case, you know, when he's first meeting Padme there, he, you know, refers to her as an angel. She has kind of this ethereal presence about her. She's, you know, from the off world, you know, almost literally, you know, this interstellar angel to Anakin. And then as you go through the story, you know, she becomes, you know, there's kind of a friendship there, right, as they're going to the Skywalker homestead, and then, you know, becomes more of a motherly figure to Anakin as they get onto the ship and are departing Naboo and going off to Coruscant. And then obviously, you know, ultimately is going to turn into this, you know, loving type of relationship here as we go through the rest of the films. But I thought that was really interesting. And then it brings up the very good point here that Anakin being kind of the quote unquote hero of the prequel trilogy, you know, Joseph Campbell describes, you know, heroes, important people, as people who tend to have long periods of obscurity, same as we saw with, you know, Luke Skywalker in A New Hope, you know, not really, you know, just living out in the desert, you know, until he's, you know, into his later teens. Same here for Anakin, you know, pretty unremarkable, I guess, by most instances, you know, until that fateful day when Qui-Gon and Padme and R2-D2 roll into town.
Yeah, and this book mentions how, like, Dante was 9 years old the first time he saw Beatrice. Like, they're both, like, around, like, nine. Like, in some cases, like, I wonder if, like, maybe the prequels would have been a little better received if, like, the character was written a little bit older. But they were trying to show, like, this good kid and his mother kind of, like, reflecting, like, when we talk about Shimi's section, kind of, like, mother and child, which isn't just like a Christian motif, but like a motif that's been around like probably as long as humans, you know, but we'll talk about that more in the future. But it's kind of like when Anakin does meet Padme, it's kind of like, I guess it's kind of like the beginning of like Anakin's connection to like the anima and like eventually his inability to let go of it, you know, like with his mom and Padme. But I do like that you mentioned like the hero of the stories usually like has a period of obscurity in their lives, because that's a mythic thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought that was interesting to think about, you know, kind of the character of Anakin, you know, in that way, and what would have been the basis for, you know, the creation, you know, of Anakin, you know, within George Lucas's mind, because, you know, he is just this young kid, but, you know, certainly has to draw on the inspirations there, because, you know, you don't want it to be a mirror of what we see with Luke Skywalker, but to still, you know, kind of give him, you know, kind of the same sort of heroic journey, and the way that he's going to, you know, kind of attach himself to the characters that we meet here in the first film. So pretty interesting stuff, I thought.
Yeah, and it does touch on like probably like Anakin leaving Shmi is probably like the original sin of Star Wars, and like I kind of think that's true, and I guess I kind of wish that would have been maybe a little bit more addressed in the sequel trilogy, but maybe like in future something, like maybe that will be addressed a little bit more. I can always hope, you know. But
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. There's always time for more Star Wars tales to fill that out, for sure. And yeah, maybe we'll get some more, you know, kind of information on that. There's a lot of really good, you know, kind of supplemental stuff to the prequel trilogy in terms of the books and novels and things that delve into that a little bit. But it'd be interesting to see it from, you know, kind of a more blown out perspective of, you know, the galaxy, you know, so far into the future, you know, what the ramifications were from, you know, this little kid. So
yeah, I think a lot of people are upset that The Phantom Menace didn't focus more on Anakin's story, but we kind of talked with Ian, like, sometimes you need, like, different perspectives, like, on someone to get the full picture, you know, and we get that with Qui-Gon, we get that with Obi-Wan, Padme and Shmi, and Palpatine, the Council, and I would say, like, most of, like, pretty much all of Anakin's story going forward is set up in The Phantom Menace. Like, we see him separated from his mom, we see, like, what a loss it is that he lost Qui-Gon, that he was kind of thrust upon Obi-Wan, like, Obi-Wan might not have chosen to be Anakin's master, but he feels a duty to do so. We see, like, his meeting with Padme, you know, and the council doesn't like him, especially Mace Windu, you know, and then we see that, you know, a certain senator who becomes a chancellor is awaiting his career with great interest, you know, so.
Yeah, that's right. All of the building blocks for Anakin's fall really take place here in the first film, in The Phantom Menace. And yeah, I think the The stories like this book in particular do a good job of kind of highlighting those individual kind of building blocks, because yeah, they're not made abundantly clear, you know, within the movie. And, you know, that could be, you know, a fault of the storytelling itself, or, you know, it's just, you know, it's this big, you know, sweeping trilogy of stories. So it's easy to kind of lose sight of those things, right? It's easy to overlook the fact of how important Qui-Gon would have been to young Anakin, yeah. You know, when you get to, you know, the Battle of the Heroes. So, you know, it's easy to kind of overlook that. So I think it's important to go back and look at these, like I said, kind of go through these thought processes of, you know, the way that, why the story was structured the way that it was.
Yeah. So we talked about Anakin. The next section is the Padawan about Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, what stood out most to you in this section?
So in this section, there was a little bit less, I thought, in the Obi-Wan section here. That's probably mostly because Obi-Wan is really kind of a side character to the story, because it's really more of Qui-Gon's story and then kind of turns into Anakin's story at the end. So it does a lot of talking about, you know, kind of what Obi-Wan's going to be, you know, later in the films in this section. But you know, kind of the big takeaways for me is that it talks about how Obi-Wan, you know, makes this quick transition from learner to teacher, and is really only taking on that undertaking because of a promise that he made to Qui-Gon. You know, it wasn't really something that he wanted to do or intended to do or had any interest in doing, but, you know, wanted to kind of fulfill that final, you know, promise that he makes to Qui-Gon. So I thought that was interesting to analyze that a little bit. And it kind of describes Obi-Wan as, you know, kind of this cloaked, you know, kind of figure, you know, in his brown robes and things, and kind of compares him to like an ancient, like Japanese, like sword master type of a character. And I thought that was kind of interesting way to portray him. But I thought that, like I said, I thought that the Obi-Wan section was probably the thinnest of this first section of the book. But what about you? What stood out to you about Obi-Wan here, the Padawan?
I kind of came to the same conclusions. There's a little bit of like, he's kind of like learning from Qui-Gon, and I think he misses some of the lessons, but I think most of the important ones he understands, except like when it's going to come to Anakin. So, but we'll see more from Obi-Wan sections in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. We'll get more into his story for sure when we get into the Attack of the Clones section of this book here at a later date. For sure, because you know, obviously a very pivotal character, but here, yeah, in the first section, not quite as much, not probably as important as the Jedi Council is here to our characters.
Yeah, I think like one of the coolest sections of the Clone Wars, or not the Clone Wars, the Phantom Menace, was about the Council, because I think a lot of people maybe didn't pay attention to the Council sections. And like, we've kind of talked about this before, like the Jedi on the Council are good, but they're just kind of misguided, and it kind of leads them to kind of fall. And the opening paragraph says, in one of the most dramatic reversals of the prequel trilogy, the Jedi of that age are not to be found scattered along the Outer Rim, hidden in desert wastes, or exiled to swampy lowlands. In the final years of the Republic, their order is located at the bright center of the galaxy, on the gleaming metropolis of Coruscant. Unlike the original films, the Jedi occupy a position of power and authority, climbing so high in the central system of the galactic government that a fall is in many ways inevitable. And like, Coruscant is like a world that like doesn't really have nature anymore. And Jedi, I kind of feel like, are supposed to be more connected to nature, you know, like in some ways, like being connected on Coruscant makes sense, but it shouldn't be like their highest priority.
Yeah, exactly. It makes a really good kind of observation, and that, you know, being that high up in Coruscant, the Jedi, who are supposed to be, you know, kind of the most grounded of people within the galaxy, are literally, you know, separated from the ground, right? There's no nature that is touching the Jedi here at all. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And I also liked kind of the imagery associated with, you know, in, you know, medieval, you know, towns and villages. The towns would be either built kind of around the base of a mountain or around the base of a cathedral would be kind of the tallest, you know, kind of point of this town where people would come together to, you know, to either worship, you know, nature or to, you know, worship in their religion. And that's kind of where the Jedi are sitting right now, you know, kind of atop of this ivory tower, almost, so to speak. So I thought that stuff was really interesting. And then I thought that it was really neat kind of then in talking about Anakin coming into the Jedi Council and, you know, kind of that first interaction when he goes in and, you know, Yoda asks him how he feels and he says cold, you know, which obviously, you know, we're led to believe is, you know, he's cold because he's, you know, missing his mother. He's away from Tatooine, things like that. But also, you know, it can represent kind of the feelings and the general vibe that the Jedi Council is putting out towards Anakin, which really becomes very important. You know, had they been, you know, more accepting of him, you know, friendlier to Anakin, you know, more hospitable, perhaps it would have been harder for Palpatine to kind of weasel his way in there and, you know, plant those seeds of doubt and angst and animosity within Anakin himself. So I really liked that kind of, you know, take on the way the Jedi Council is portrayed here in The Phantom Menace.
Yeah, and there was this paragraph I highlighted, like, if you saw my books, like, you'd be like, you kind of highlighted everything. So therefore, nothing is highlighted. But it was a paragraph I highlighted, and it says, this exchange regarding Anakin is all the more intriguing when juxtaposed against a passage from The Hero with a Thousand Faces. For the mythological hero is the champion not of things become, but of things becoming. The dragon to be slain by him is precisely the monster of the status quo. Hold fast, the keeper of the past, writes Campbell. From obscurity, the hero emerges, but the enemy is great and conspicuous in the seat of power. And it's kind of like, I don't know, there's like a passage in Corinthians that it says, like, the gist is like, you're a new creature, old things pass away, all things become new, you know? That's kind of like what a hero, like, it can be like in any sense, like governmental, spiritual, I guess, like in different ways too, but I think like the Jedi were just kind of like so focused on like what was, like, and if, like, if, like you said, like, if they kind of like maybe were nicer to Anakin and like kind of like were open, more open to change, more open to the living force, like, maybe he could have brought balance a little bit nicer in a way, you know, right, to the Jedi.
yeah, absolutely. It would have made things much more smoother sailing, I think, for the Jedi in the long run had they been a little bit more hospitable, you know, to Anakin. You know, give him like a snack, send him on his way. You know, you don't have to be jerks to him. Mace Windu, come on, what are you doing, guy? But yeah, I thought that was interesting kind of to analyze, you know, the reception of Anakin there by the Jedi Council, you know, in addition to them sitting, you know, robed in their very fancy chamber atop of their very fancy building on their very fancy planet. But also, you know, just the way that they're interacting with people, you would think that, you know, the Jedi should be humble and more open and caring to people around the galaxy. And that's, you know, not what we get when we make our way back to Coruscant. So.
Yeah, and speaking of Coruscant, there is a certain senator who becomes a chancellor, wielding the weapon of politics, and that is, of course, Sheev Palpatine. And one of the, would it be like the thesis statements of the prequel trilogy is like, how does a dictatorship like arise from a republic? Like, we get to kind of see that throughout the prequels. Like, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of the kind of the general theme of this, I think, especially, you know, then as you get into, you know, stuff like Andor and Rogue One is kind of the culmination of how does that really happen. But yeah, we're definitely seeing the birth of that happen right here. Even so much to, you know, it kind of, it makes the observation that, you know, Palpatine was basically kind of a, you know, a derivative of the name Palatine or Palatine, which is basically the hill that Romulus stood on when he declared himself as, you know, founder of Rome. So, you know, kind of the same kind of things here now as he's, you know, standing there in the Senate, you know, declaring himself, you know, full-blown emperor. So, yeah, it's really interesting kind of rise to power. And it's interesting, you know, politically from that standpoint to watch Palpatine and how he's able to pull all of these strings. I like there was also some good kind of imagery noted here, and that, you know, Palpatine's office is all red, which, you know, George Lucas has said because it's supposed to, you know, be indicative of, you know, being, you know, in the fires of hell, there kind of in his office. And then you'll see him when, you know, Amidala is making her statement to, you know, oust the chancellor, to give rise to Palpatine. He's kind of standing over her shoulder, you know, kind of akin to like that little devil, whispering in your ear. And I like that kind of stuff that you might not, you know, just notice or pick up on your initial, you know, 100 viewings of The Phantom Menace like we've all had now at this point. But I really liked, you know, kind of analyzing stuff like that too, so.
Yeah, and I like that you mentioned that Palpatine might come from Palatine, because it's like Palpatine can also sound like puppeteer, you know, like many different things. But I think like originally when Lucas was done with the prequels, he was going to like cover like the rise and fall of Rome, like the rise of Imperial Rome, along with like the fall of the Roman Republic, but he didn't quite get around to it. But in some ways I would say like the prequels did a pretty good job of like showing, like you see like in episode one, like at times, like, it's kind of like Senator Palpatine will do one thing, but then his alter ego, Darth Sidious, like, it's like, oh, Senator Palpatine's like, I sent some Jedi diplomats. And then, like, Darth Sidious is like, yeah, kill those Jedi diplomats. And it's like, oh, no, what happened? but, like, he's playing right. Both sides, you know? And, like, I like how you mentioned that Palpatine is kind of like the devil, kind of like manipulating Padme. Like sometimes he's not technically lying to her, but he is manipulating her. Like it's like maybe Obi-Wan needs to be like, huh, maybe I shouldn't tell the truth from a certain point of view, you know? Because right. That's kind of what Palpatine's doing too.
Yeah, exactly. He's using the truth, you know, in a lot of instances to, you know, further his own agenda. And obviously, you know, he's kind of playing, you know, both sides of the coin. So he has that going for him. But yeah, especially, and it talks about this, and it talked about it a little bit, you know, kind of in, you know, Queen Amidala's section there, Padme's section, that, you know, really the actions of the Phantom Menace were to do what's right, right? She was greasing the wheels of, you know, justice, so to speak, to get some relief and justice and help for her people, right? She wasn't doing any of the things that she did for anything, you know, other than those means. But, you know, Palpatine was able to kind of see that need and bend it to his will, I guess.
Yeah, and kind of because the Sith, like, kind of kept their numbers to just two, like a master and an apprentice. It saved the Sith Dark Order, but it also kind of forced them and also helped them to think creatively. So like in many ways, like Palpatine's like the ultimate incarnation of what a Sith is, like, and it's like what he did was horrible, but he did think outside the box.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It made them more adaptable, and yeah, had to figure out ways to do it, because you don't have an entire Jedi Council, right? If you're just, you know, one Sith, or you're self and an apprentice, or you know, whatever the case may be. So you have to really kind of, you know, ascend to a different level of thinking and planning and manipulating to further your agenda.
Yeah, Ian McDiarmid is probably for me like one of the best performances in the prequel trilogy. Some people have Ewan McGregor as their number one, but it's very close. But I would honestly maybe say Ian McDiarmid, because he just knows how to go big, go dramatic, and it's just, I don't know, like, it's just so interesting but sad to kind of just see like this pattern from history. Like it's like it's not an outside force for the most part, you know, that leads to the fall. It like it comes from within, and it's really sad.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the next section is about the mother, Shmi Skywalker, and it opens with this paragraph. It says, this woman with her baby is the basic image of mythology, Joseph Campbell observed in one of the lectures collected in Transformations of Myth Through Time, referring to a single picture of a tribal mother and her child, when one can feel oneself in relation to the universe in the same complete and natural way as that of the child with the mother, one is in complete harmony and in tune with the universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So you got the section here about the mother, and it talks a lot about, you know, kind of the themes of having a virgin birth. You know, Shmi says, you know, that there was no father. You she carried Anakin, and that was kind of that. You know, and here in the West, in the United States, we think of virgin birth. You know, we think of Christianity, but you know, the virgin birth, you know, story and you know, mythological tales and tellings, you know, that's rooted in a lot of different religions and a lot of different folklores and things like that. So, you know, that's very kind of indicative of where that came from. But what I really liked kind of about Shmi's little section here is that it talks about mothers turning their sons or their children's into an idol to be kind of held and kept in the perils of that, and not being able to, you know, kind of let them go. And, you know, Shmi is able to do that here in the story, but I really liked, you know, kind of thinking about the characters kind of in that sense, as Anakin, you know, being propped up. You know, we always talk about Anakin, you know, kind of putting Padme on a pedestal, but, you know, Anakin at the same time was also being put on a pedestal, you know, by Shmi and by Qui-Gon. And then, you know, potentially by the Jedi Council as we go through the story here, as being this chosen one figure. So I thought that stuff was really pretty interesting stuff about Shmi, a character that I wish we got a lot more time with, to be honest.
Yeah, totally. And we kind of see that on the cover. So McDonald knew what he was doing when he chose that cover. So because it has, you know, Shmi and Anakin, she's holding Anakin, and they both have halos, you know, so really good from a symbolic perspective. And it's kind of like she is the mother giving a virgin birth, you know, and some people say, oh, it's Palpatine, or oh, it's Plagueis, you know, but it seems like George Lucas, like, while he did kind of play around with those ideas, it's kind of like the Force kind of brought Anakin to be through Shmi. You kind of wonder, like, what would have happened if Anakin would have stayed on Tatooine. And that's one of those mysteries, kind of like, I don't know, it would be cool. It'll never, ever happen, at least in my lifetime. But, like, what if there was, like, a comic book series, like a Star Wars What If, like, where Anakin was taught by Qui-Gon, like, how would the prequels have been different? Would they have been different, you know? But it's kind of interesting, like, it talks about, like, C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, and it's kind of like, later on it says, Lewis also reminds us that the gates of hell are locked from the inside, a sentiment of profound significance in the Star Wars saga. So, like, where Shmi did give birth to Anakin, she's able to let him go, but Anakin isn't able to let her go. It's kind of a reversal from a lot of stories, I think. So like Anakin, when he kind of loses Shmi and Padme, kind of like locks himself up in the Darth Vader armor, like a living tomb.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of the way he chooses to protect himself and probably protect his, you know, feelings and emotions, you know, after suffering, you know, all of the loss and the pain and torment. That, yeah, obviously the suit is, you know, keeping him alive, but it's also kind of a suit of armor to protect him against, you know, having any more hurt come his way, I suppose.
Yeah. So, the next section is The Fool. It is about Jar Jar Binks. And Jar Jar Binks and Ahmed Best got way too much undeserved hate. And Jar Jar Binks was the first fully computer-generated character in cinema history, one of the first mocap characters in movie history. But everyone seems to be able to be like, oh, I found something to complain about, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And if you look back at any of the behind the scenes stuff, you know, Jar Jar was doing exactly as he was directed to do. So, yeah, I don't understand the hate for him. And I think that this book actually does a really good job of, you know, kind of addressing that in a way, and why people might have been turned off by him, and you know, kind of you know, equating kind of the way that he's moving and has kind of this more amphibian look to him, which, you know, as humans we're predisposed to not, you know, find as palatable, I guess. I think it says, you know, as to, you know, like furry creatures, you know, like dogs and cats and bears, yeah, and things like that. You know, we're more predisposed to liking things that are soft and cuddly versus, you know, things that are more reptilian in nature. So I think maybe it was just kind of subconsciously a little bit of that in, you know, in addition to the way that he's kind of going around. But I really liked kind of the section, and you know, it talked about how, you know, kind of this bumbling nonsensicalness, you know, kind of dates back, you know, especially like in children's stories, and it goes back and it, you know, ties in and makes the connection to something like Alice in Wonderland, which is very, you know, kind of fantastical and nonsensical, and you know, has entire, you know, poems of, you know, things that aren't real words and stuff like that. So you definitely could see the ties there, and I liked that. I thought that made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and I guess humans, we have a bias for like fellow mammals. You know, we have a mammalian bias. Like, we like fuzzy teddy bears, you know, chewy, you know, like only Han could really, well, I guess all the characters could understand Chewy, but like we, the audience, like, are just like, oh, it sounds like Chewy's growling, you know? So like we're Chewbacca's tall, you know, and fuzzy, and like we couldn't understand him. Like Jar Jar is the reptile, also tall, we can understand him, and like he just doesn't like speak basic the way others do. It doesn't mean it's wrong, it's just how Jar Jar speaks, kind of like a child, you know? And like that's, he kind of represents the jester, you know? It's kind of like they can sometimes see the truths that like the nobility can't, you know? And it's like kind of like a, you know, like it's used in the fairy tale, you know, like the princess and the frog princess. So it's a nice play on that motif.
Yeah, I really liked, you know, I talked a lot about the princess and the frog, and basically, if you're not familiar with that fairy tale, a princess loses a little golden ball down a well, and the frog goes and gets it, and then the princess has to live with the frog, who turns out to be a prince, I believe, at the end of the story. But it talks a lot about that, and then like even you go down like under the water to like go to Gunga, and like those are like literal like big gold balls that they're living in. They're the Gungans, and I thought that illustration was kind of neat. And then it, you know, talks about Jar Jar as being, you know, kind of this jester, kind of this fool character, who is, you know, kind of like Kind of, you know, kind of akin to like a trickster character.
Yeah.
But really is going through as a trickster is more, kind of focused in and doing things on purpose. You know, the fooler or the jester character is doing those things, but, you know, just out of complete accident. And it talks about how, you know, Jar Jar basically is clumsily making his way, you know, through the story, you know, saving Qui-Gon or, you know, yeah, saving Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan and getting through and taking out all these battle droids and things like that through the story, you know, through the actions that he's taking, but he's not taking them for any real purpose other than that's just, you know, who Jar Jar is just by being himself. And I thought that stuff was really interesting. I think that it did a really good job actually of kind of analyzing the character of Jar Jar, which is nice because you don't ever think about Jar Jar on any sort of analytical level other than, you know, just the fact that a lot of people seem to not like him. And hopefully those days are behind us now. But yeah. I really like this section. I thought that it was really fun and a really good way to round out the Phantom Menace section here of the book.
Yeah, I kind of wish that Jar Jar would have had more of a role in episode 2 and 3, but I guess, you know, we're on the end of that section takes us to page 66. So, like, in the future, we will cover the heresies of Attack of the Clones, which I am going to heretically say is the most George Lucasian of the Star Wars. There have been many ones, you know, so
that's right, there were six, so I guess we'll see if we can agree on that after we go into the heresies. But yeah, I think that these are fun. So obviously, you know, if you're following the podcast, you've seen that we've started to do the hero's journeys for the movies, and then trying to look at these a little bit more analytically here too. So talking the heresies here for the prequel trilogy. So let us know if you're listening out there what you thought about this stuff, or if you've read the heresies, or if you have any other kind of ties to our Phantom Menace characters, or you know, any ties to mythology, or you know, religion, any of that stuff, how it pertains to the prequel trilogy. Let us know, because we think that stuff's really interesting.
Yeah, we hope you're having a good one, and may the force be with you.
The Older Public Podcast can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, as well as everywhere else that Anchor Podcasts are distributed. Subscriptions, reviews, and shares help us out.
And if you want to connect with the podcast on Twitter, we can be found at Old Republic Pod. And if you want to connect with me, I can be found on Instagram at Astro_Droid_.
You can find us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/Old Republic Podcast. Our intro and outro themes were composed by Dennis S. Mowers at DennisSMowersMusic.com.
This episode of the Old Republic Podcast has been brought to you by Nikki Dog from Patreon. May the Force be with you. We will be back soon. Bye for now.